Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Before employee assistance programs and community health care clinics that understood mental health care, even before there was a word for it, before medicine was at the center of psychiatric care, and before Kansas Osawatomie State Hospital was struggling, before all that, there was the Menninger Clinic in Topeka. As part of a series on mental health care in Kansas by Heartland Health Monitor, a reporting collaboration based here at KCUR, we're taking a look today at the history of the Menninger Clinic and how it became so influential, and how it eventually changed and moved away. Joining us is Roy Menninger. He was president of the clinic for a quarter century, from the 1960s until 1990. Roy, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
It's great to meet you. This was a family business, wasn't it?
Initially, it was, although it stopped being a family business when it was obvious to raise money for a nonprofit organization, you had to change its governance. So in 1941, we became a public not-for-profit corporation.
But your family was still integrally involved through much of its history.
Yeah, as far as the family was concerned, we didn't pay much attention to it one way or the other.
how was your grandfather involved in all this?
Well, grandfather was a very kindly man who inclined to do what people would like him to do. He went to Mayo Clinic in the 1912, and he was so impressed with the fact that the doctors actually talked to each other. Bear in mind, this was a time when doctors were very proprietary. Anything they found or discovered, they would not share with anybody. So Dr. C.F. was very much impressed with this collegial environment. He came back to Topeka. The story is he sat down at the dinner table one evening and announced to the three sons there, "You're going to be doctors and we're going to have a clinic." Well, two of them did, and sure enough, they had a clinic. It actually became psychiatric when Dr. Carl, who was trained in Boston, came back in about 1920 and persuaded grandfather, who was a horse and buggy doctor, he was a general practitioner, persuaded him that this was the way to go, and grandfather said, by all means, there we were.
What was it before it was a psychiatric clinic?
Well, it was a private practice of my grandfather's.
Okay. So for those who don't know, talk about what the Menninger Clinic represented in terms of the world of mental health care. What did it become known for?
It's hard to summarize in 25 words or less, but
I'll give you 50.
let me try. Well, what happened in the beginning was that the clinic in the 1920s, even into the 1930s, was operating in an environment in which the mentally ill, if they got any, I hesitate to call it treatment, got it at the state hospital. But they were, frankly, snake pits, as was well described at one point, even a movie made of it, because people, it was a warehouse for human beings. It was not a treatment center. Dr. Carl and Dr. C.F. started this with a special concept of hope and commitment. And the result was that the people who came there initially, they were mostly neurology patients, but later on, increasingly psychiatric. And then in 1931, I think, Dr. Carl wrote a book called The Human Mind. This had a tremendous impact on the nation as a whole because it was the first time a literate psychiatrist had put down in black and white something about the mental activities of the brain. So it went to establish a reputation. But subsequent to that, what happened really was the development of an environment that was therapeutic. Both Dr. Carl and Dr. C.F. said, treatment has to be more than the doctor coming by for morning rounds and giving you a whole 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be day and night. You're the clock around. So they did that. And the way they did it was to train the nurses first and then all the other ancillary housekeepers, aides, even the people who worked on the grounds, who worked in the kitchen, all were given some rudimentary training in mental health. And this enabled them to be therapeutic no matter who was talking with the patient.
Wow.
This gave rise to what later became known as milieu therapy. I mean, once you get a name on something, it's really important and you've got to bow down before it. But prior to that, it was an attitude. It was a statement of make the patient important in ways that are therapeutic to them.
And this represented a very different approach to the hospital setting you mentioned. It also sounds very different than what we think of today when we think of mental health care.
Alas, alas, you are entirely right. Unfortunately, the method that we developed was expensive in two ways. One is it requires a lot of staff, not just doctors, but also nurses, aides, and occupational therapists, and so on and on and on. And the second is people don't recognize the fact. It's so obvious when you point it out, but it's not obvious to begin with. Mental illness is a chronic problem. It's not the sort of thing that spend 3 days, take 2 aspirin, and call me in the morning. You're all well. On the contrary, it's a long, continued, in many cases, a lifelong problem. So treatment cannot be 3 days or 5 days or 7 days and make any sense. So many of our patients were there for 3 months, 6 months, sometimes even a year or two.
So would you be offended if I asked how old you are?
I'm almost 90.
Okay, almost 90.
Yeah, I try to act my age.
So you've seen a lot of this development happen over the course of not just your family clinic, but really the whole world of psychiatric care. I guess as you look back, what was it like growing up around all that? I mean, you were a kid when this was first developing.
Well, that was to my benefit, actually, because I had nothing to do with it. The rules at that time were quite strict, and that is families of nobody who didn't belong there was permitted to go onto the campus. That even applied to my mother.
Really?
She was politely excluded. The exception was Sunday. On Sunday, my father would take me to his office, and one day he showed me this incredible device. It sat on a little stand by itself. It had a black roll in it, looked like a toilet paper. It went round and round and round. And he was talking to it with a sort of a megaphone at the other end. It was a dictaphone. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. And hearing my voice come back from that dictaphone, I tell you, I shall never forget it. That was my contact with psychiatry at that time.
Every kid loves to hear their own voice, right?
Yes, well.
And every radio talk show host as well, I have to admit. Are you sad that the field changed so much from those early days?
Oh, tremendously. I'm not just sad because for economic reasons, our organization had to leave town and go south to Texas to join up with Baylor. What really saddens me is that the whole concept of treatment has shifted to a short-term concept. It is 3 days or 5 days or 7 days. That's all you can have. That's all the insurance company will give you. And probably the hospital will throw you out if you're not over well by then. And the consequence of that is that there's a tremendous reliance on medication. There are medications for every imaginable disorder, and some of them work and some of them don't. And you don't always know which is which until you've tried it. But what it has also done is minimize the importance of the doctor-patient relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship was the key factor when we had patients in our hospital. We were working with them every day. We saw them every day. We talked with them every day. The relationship was a major thing that helped them get better. Well, that's what do you hear about that now?
Yeah.
There's a little effort to try to get general physicians to be more aware of the importance of the relationship. But I'm afraid they're swimming uphill because it's not necessarily easy to do, especially if you're not inclined to do that, and not everybody is.
People came from a long ways around to the Menninger Clinic, didn't they?
Oh, indeed. All over the world.
The rich and the famous.
Not always. There were some not so rich and considerably less famous. But we had a charitable program that certainly allowed patients to stay on even when their money ran out because we had... Partly because we had invested an enormous amount of time and energy and people power in their getting as well as they did. So we wanted to continue to do that as long as we could.
How did the clinic come to have this international reputation that it eventually came to have?
Oh, essentially word of mouth. As I said, Dr. Carl's book on the human mind was a tremendous impetus. Then during the war, my father was a general who was head of all the psychiatrists in the armed forces. Now, at that time, the armed forces meant the Army, because the Navy had something and the Air Force had something separate. But this was this put him in touch with a great many people around the world. It also gave him an opportunity to discover new ways of treating patients. It took a while before the lessons that we actually learned in the First World War and then forgotten could be relearned. And one of them is that the sooner you got help for somebody and the closer to the front line he was, the more rest you could give him, the more likely he was to return to active duty.
Do you think that part of the influence came from the folks, the training that went on there, as well as the patient care? I mean, people came there not only to be treated, but to learn how to be effective.
Oh, indeed. In fact, that all had a rather interesting beginning right after the war when Dr. Will came back and Dr. Carr was, he had stayed at the clinic all during the war. They had a call from the general who was head of the VA system at that time. I think it was called by some other name. He said, we've got all these people coming out of the service who are ill. They've had battle fatigue, which is what we called it then, a variety of other conditions, but we need people to treat them. So will you take some for treat? I'm sorry, will you take some for training? And Carl and Will thought about it over the weekend. He called him back on Monday and said, we had two then, I think. He said, well, we could take two more. And the general roared back in his chair and he said, two, hell, there are going to be 50 there on the first of July. And sure enough, there were. So for a while in the 50s and 60s, 7% of the psychiatrists in this country had been trained in Topeka. And, of course, they've gone everywhere.
70%, you said?
At one point. I'm sorry. I misspoke. At 7%.
7%. I think you may have said 7%. That's still a huge percentage given Topeka's size.
Yeah. And of course, this was very early when there were very few training programs. One of the things our training program did was to make it much more systematic. Typically, if a doctor was going to learn something, he literally sat at the knee of his preceptor and was taught hands-on, almost as if you were the child and he was reading you a story. But Carl instituted a much more systematic way of examining the diagnoses, the nature of illness, the varieties of illness. And all this was done in the context of what was then very important, psychoanalytic theory. Mm-hmm. Because that formed a basis for putting ideas together in ways that made sense. And there's nothing like making sense of something to give you some possibility of doing something about it.
Right.
If it looks just chaos and you don't know where to start, nothing changes.
So you mentioned that eventually the clinic left Topeka, it moved to Texas. Can you talk a little bit more about why that happened?
Yeah, it was inevitable, I must say, and I'm not sure all of us realized it at the time. We had a very large campus, over 300 acres, sitting on the top of a hill in Topeka, which made it a very serene and therapeutic environment all by itself. There were also quite a number of buildings on it. But in addition, we had a very large staff. At one point, we had 1,200 employees. And there were more than 100 who were professionals of one kind or another. So the expense of the individuals and the expense of maintaining a large campus combined with a very sharp reduction in what the insurance company said they were willing to pay, plus the fact they were cutting us back, but okay, you can have 1 month, you can't have three or four. And then they said, well, you can have 2 weeks. Well, now you can only have 1 week. Well, they really forced us to change the system completely or quit. And what we elected to do then was to try to salvage something of the attitude and the spirit and the legacy. We were able to arrange with Baylor to become a part of their system. In fact, the Department of Psychiatry is now known as the Menninger School of Psychiatry at Baylor.
And do you feel like that the attitude has persisted there? Does the legacy live on in what's happening at Baylor?
Well, I think to their credit, they're trying very hard to make it move on. But there's some things working against them. When people came to Topeka for training, they might say, oh, okay, I'm going to stay on 1 year. 10 years later, they were still there. And that was partly because of the environment, but partly because Topeka, the Manninger place was the only game in town. In Houston, that's not true. There are lots of places you can go. So you might spend a month here or 3 months there and then move on somewhere else. So it's very hard to have a stable treatment population or a stable patient population long enough to work with them.
And so that's a way that the medical practice legacy has not been able to carry on just because of the realities. Do you feel like your family's spirit about this work has persisted? Is there a legacy that lives on about the original work of the Manninger Clinic?
Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask patients who were there, they give you, in most cases, an unequivocally yes answer. If you actually ask some of the people who worked there, you get some very interesting replies. Some will say, that's the most interesting place I ever worked. Say, those are the best years of my life. Well, you know, remarks like that are very powerful. In fact, we are having a reunion of the staff this next month. And that with some 350 people are coming. Now, for 10 years after the move, they're all coming back. That's tremendous.
That is tremendous, and it sounds like a great event. Roy Manninger was president of the Manninger Clinic in Topeka for 25 years, and his family was part of getting it started. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
You can find the Heartland Health Monitor series, The State of Mental Health, and all their other excellent work at kcur.org/health. You can also find our program online. Our recent shows are there, including today's. That'll be up later this afternoon. It's all at kcur.org/Central Standard. If you're on Twitter, you can follow us there. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Join us tomorrow. We'll find out what kids have been up to this summer and how that's different than it used to be. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our team includes Suzanne Hogan, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Our intern is Anna Sterla. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.